What we were doing at the end of last time was Shor's algorithm. I showed you kind of the overview of it and how to do the modular exponentiation. And then I want to finish it up today. So just to remind you, here's what Shor's algorithm looks like as a quantum circuit, roughly speaking. So the first thing I want to discuss then is how you do this Fourier transform. Remember the Fourier transform, the discrete Fourier transform mod 2 to the n, and it's supposed to map A to sum over b omega to the a b b, where omega is e to the 2 pi I over 2 to the n. Okay, so how are we going to do that? So we're going to write the input and the output in their binary expansions. And so the input a is A0, 2 to the n minus 1, plus A1, 2 to the n minus 2, plus A2, 2 to the n minus 3, dot, 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 A n minus 1. And B is similarly B0, 2 to the n minus 1, plus B1, 2 to the n minus 2, plus 2, 3, dot, dot, plus the n minus 1. Okay. And so now I want to expand this AB product as the product of these sums. And we're doing it this way in order to kind of break this down into things that involve only pairs of bits, right? Two qubit operations. So we have AB equals 2 to the n times something plus 2 to the n. So before I continue. So the 2 to the n times something, and we actually have, you know, higher powers of 2. But anything that gets a power of 2 to the n is not going to matter, right? Because what we're interested in is omega to the ab. And so if we have 2 to the n times something, that's omega to the 2 pi I times something, which is just going to give us 1. So any power over 2 to the n, 2 to the n or higher, it doesn't affect us at all. We can just ignore it. So let's start with the powers 2 to the n minus 1. So what do we have? We have a0, the n minus 1, and a1, the n minus 2, all the way to a n minus 1, e0. And then we have 2 to the n minus 2, a1, b, n minus 1, plus dot, 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 plus a n minus 1, b1, and so on and so forth, down to 2 to the 0, a n minus 1, b n minus 1. Okay? So it turns out that in order to understand how to break this down into two qubit gates, it's most convenient to write the bits of the input in order. and then the bits at the output in reverse order. So basically, we're mapping from something that looks like this, a 0, a 1, a 2, dot, 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 a n minus 1, to something that looks like this. We're going to have a sum over b, of course, omega to the ab, b n minus 1, e n minus 2, e n minus 3, dot, 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 b 0. So after we do the Fourier transform, we've actually reversed the order of the bits. But that doesn't really, you know, change the thing. It just kind of makes it more convenient to write. So let's expand this omega to the AB in terms of these things. So what do we get? We get let's pull out the terms in omega in this sum that depends on bn minus 1, bn minus 2, bn minus 3. Any one term only has one b in it, right? So we can just factor it out this way. And so we have omega to the a0, 2 to the n minus 1, that's here. And we have a1, 2 to the n minus 2. And so on, all the way down to the last term that has the n minus 1 is the final one. Okay. And then we have to do the same thing for bn minus 2. So we have sum bn minus 2, omega. So now bn minus 2 only starts with a1. Right, so we have a1, 2 to the n minus 1, plus a2, 2 to the n minus 2, plus dot, dot, dot. And then we never get all the way down to 2 to the 0. We just get down to 2 to the 1. So we have a n minus 1, 2 to the 1. B n minus 2, n minus 1. Okay. B n minus 2. B n minus 2. Okay. And then, of course, we have lots more of these things until the final one, which is sum over b0, omega, the a, n minus 1, 2 to the n minus 1, b0. OK, and that's coming from here. OK? So, OK, it's maybe not clear whether this is progress or not, but it is. So let's just think about one of these terms, say. Or let's do one in the middle. We'll do it on a different board. Okay, so what do we have? So we have b n minus I, which can be 0 or 1, of course. And we have omega to the, so I wanna break up this sum into two terms. And I guess we can convert it into a product. So we're going to have omega to the a I, well, here, product later. Omega to the a I minus 1, 2 to the n minus I. No, sorry, 2 to the n minus 1. So the theme here being that this plus this is equal to, the first one here is equal to n minus 1. So n minus I plus I minus 1 gives us the n minus 1 term. Then we have the product over j greater than or equal to I of omega to the aj to, well, sorry, and this is supposed to have a bn minus I in it. And I guess we can put the bn minus I here. And we have 2 to the n minus 2 minus j minus I. Okay? So, so what this is a sequence of phase shifts. Right? And so what we want to do is we want to implement each of these phase shifts. So the first thing to notice is that this phase here is omega is e to the 2 pi I over 2 to the n. And then we're taking it to the power 2 to the n minus 1 times some either 0 or 1. And so the 2 to the n minus 1 almost cancels the 2 to the n. We have omega to the 2 pi I over 2, which is minus 1. So this is minus 1 to the a I minus 1 b n minus I. And notice that the way we've lined things up, maybe I put them too far apart, but I minus 1 is appearing here right over b n minus I. So it's actually the same qubit that we're talking about here, with the value before the Fourier transform and the value after the Fourier transform. Okay? So what that is this is just doing the Hadamard on the ith qubit. Or this is, I should say, the phase that you would get if you did the Hadamard on the ith qubit, which will also convert a I minus 1 into b n minus I when you do that with this sum here. Okay? So if we didn't have these phases at all, that's exactly what we would have. Okay? And then these phases are a 2-qubit phase shift for j greater than or equal to I. So there are a's that are further down on the right here with this particular qubit that we're interested in at the moment. Okay? So we can do those. So if we do the Hadamard on this qubit and then do these phase shifts, we'll get the right answer, provided we haven't done Hadamards on these later qubits. And each one of these terms works that way. Right? So what we can do is we can start with a Hadamard on the first qubit and then phase shifts between these qubits and this one, and then a Hadamard on this one and phase shifts between these two qubits and this one, and so on. So what do we get when we do that? We get something that looks like this. So we start here. So I have the a zero plus one. So we start with a Hadamard up here. And then we want to do these controlled phase shifts. So what's the actual phase shift? Well, it depends on j minus I. Right? And so if j minus I is 1, did I write this correctly? Yeah, so let me rephrase. So this phase here is e to the 2 pi I 2 to the n minus 2 minus j minus I over 2 to the n. So we can cancel the 2 to the n's and we get on the bottom, 2 pi I over 2 to the 2 plus j minus I. I feel like that's off by one. Oh, I see, right. Because we're starting with j is equal to I. That's why. Okay. And then we have the, up on top, we have the aj b n minus I. Okay. So the thing where they differ by one is the j equals I case. So that's a phase shift of 2 pi I over 4. Which, what am I calling that? An R pi over 2 gate. And then we have an R pi over 4 gate here, half the angle. And so on down the line to R pi over 2 to the n minus 2. I need a bigger box. Okay? But that's just the first qubit. But then we have to do the same thing for the second qubit. What does that look like? Well, we again do the Hadamard here. And then we do a controlled R pi over 2. And down the line until we get the controlled R pi over 2 to the n minus 3. So it's a slightly smaller phase shift. Well, smaller by a factor of 2. And then we do the Hadamard here. And similarly controlled phase shifts down until we get R to the pi over 2 to the n minus 4. And then so on and so forth until we finally just do the Hadamard on this qubit. And then what we get out is these b's in reverse order. So b n minus 1, b n minus 2, b n minus 3, down to b 0. Okay? And that's the Fourier count. So how many gates are in this? Well, we start out with n gates, one for each qubit. And then we do n minus 1 gates, and n minus 2 gates, and so on. So we have n plus n minus 1 plus n minus 2 plus all the way down to 1, which is order n squared. N plus 1 choose. Okay? So the Fourier transform has complexity O of n squared. Are there any questions on this? Okay. So I guess one thing that's worth pointing out, you may remember that the modular exponentiation that we did yesterday is O of n cubed in the naive case, or with fast multiplication tricks, still something that's bigger than O of n squared. So in the asymptotic limit, Schur's algorithm, the complexity of Schur's algorithm is actually dominated by the, not the classical part, but the part that's essentially classical, right? It's being performed on superposition, but it's basically just a classical circuit. Okay, so that's an interesting aspect of it. And the other side, of course, is that this modular exponentiation is also what you have to do in RSA if you want to encode. So Schur's algorithm to break RSA is not substantially slower. I mean, it may depend on the actual parameters of the code, but it's not really substantially slower than encrypting using RSA. Right? So that's really a powerful attack. Okay. So then the last thing I need to show you about Schur's algorithm is what to do when last time we had this simplifying assumption that the period that we're trying to figure out is a factor of 2 to the n, where n here is the number of qubits that we picked here. But of course, in general, the periods will not be multiples of 2 at all. So we can't just pick a big power of 2 and hope for the best. So we have to figure out what happens in the general case. That's too high. So, so what if R, sorry, does not divide 2 to the n? So, remember what we had pictorially. So, I'm not going to go through all the details here because it can get kind of grungy and complicated. But before, remember, before the Fourier transform, we had something that was periodic and looked like this, with some a0 and period r here. And then the Fourier transform, what does the Fourier transform do? It extracts the periods in a function. And so what happens when r, so when r divides 2 to the n, this thing is exactly periodic, right? Because I've drawn it as a line, but you go back to the beginning, and this period here was also r. But if r does not divide 2 to the n, this period here is not r. It's something else. It's not a period anymore, right? It's a glitch in the periodicity. But it's still the case that we have many, many things of period r, right? Many spikes with this period. So the Fourier transform, which is supposed to extract the frequencies that appear in something, is still going to have big spikes at multiples of this period, r, or inverse r, right? But they won't be perfect. There'll be some imperfections there that cause it not to be a series of spikes, but instead it'll be kind of very narrow, but still finite width spikes at multiples of 1 over the period. Okay. And so the bigger n is, the more spikes we have that have the right spacing, right? And so the narrower these Fourier transform spikes will be. And so it turns out So the other thing that's worth saying is that when I write 1 over r, these things are still, we're still representing them as integers, the values post Fourier transform. And so what I really mean is 2 to the n over r. 2 to the n over 2 to the, sorry, 2 times 2 to the n over r and 3 times 2 to the n over r. And when r does not divide 2 to the n, these are not integers. Okay. These spikes are not centered on actual points, but there's still amplitudes that are there. So what we're going to get is we're going to get some multiple, some integer value that happens to be close to one of these multiples of 1 over r. And the odds are it's going to be, you know, plus or minus 1. But because these things have finite width, it, you know, non-negligible probability of being plus or minus 2 or plus or minus 3. Is that the question? You started to raise your hand.
Yeah, but you kind of answered it.
Okay. Okay. So, right. So, so how big should n be so that these spikes are sufficiently narrow for our purposes? And it turns out that if we pick 2 to the n to be about n squared, which means that n is about 2 log big N, then these peaks are narrow enough. And by narrow enough, I mean that the probability of getting something that's sufficiently close to a multiple of r that we're going to be able to figure out r is high. And so, of course, the classical post-processing is also going to be more complicated, right? Before, we had different multiples of 1 over r, and we just had to take the GCD to actually figure out what 1 over r was. Now, we don't exactly have multiples of 1 over r. We have things that are approximately multiples of 1 over r. And so the way to deal with this is a continued fraction expansion. So the continued fraction expansion, well, you can write a continued fraction expansion for any real number, but what we're interested in is a rational number, something over 2 to the n, basically. So the point is that we're getting something, measurement outcome B, which is approximately C 2 to the n over R. And so what we'd like to figure out is, well, really what we want to figure out is R, but C over R is a good first step, right? And so what we do is we look at B over 2 to the n, and that's supposed to be close to C over R. And we want to use that as an approximation to figure out C over R. So we write the continued fraction expansion of B over 2 to the n. It's something that looks like this. And because this is rational, this continued fraction expansion terminates. So it only have finitely many terms like this. We can write them all out. And this is something that's pretty easy to find. So these C's can be integers. I guess in this case, C0 is always going to be 0. But you just take 1 over and find the smallest integer and the largest integer that's less than it. And then subtract that off and keep going. So then there's some math, and which comes with the assertion that if you look at the continued fraction expansion for C over R, when these two things are sufficiently close together, then C over R's continued fraction expansion, which looks like this, happens to have the same coefficients up to a certain point. I guess this one ends earlier than this because R is smaller than 2 to the n. And so what we can do is we can write out this continued fraction expansion and try truncating it at various points. Okay? And those will give us candidates for C over R. And once we repeat Shor's algorithm a few times, we'll have different candidates for different, C over R, C1 over R, C2 over R, well, sorry, I should call them something else. C over R, C prime over R, C double prime over R. And by putting those together, you can kind of figure out what the most likely R is. So I know there's a bunch of details missing in here, but as I said, the math can get reasonably crunchy, and I don't want to have to go into. Hopefully, this gives you an idea of how it works. Okay? And of course, if what we're really interested in is factoring, you don't have to be, do this so many times that you're really sure that you've gotten the right R. If you have a kind of a decent candidate for R, you can use it, see if it's even. If so, use it and see if x to the r over 2 is not equal to minus 1. Then you can, if it's not that, then you can use it to get a factor, a potential factor of n. And if you succeed, that's easy to check, right? Somebody gives you a factor, you just try dividing it into n and see if it works. Okay. And once you've got that, then you don't have to do any more work. So you don't have to be very sure about what R is. Given a possible R, kind of a plausible R, you can just go ahead with that. OK? So So that concludes what I wanted to say about factoring. Are there any questions about Quasar? I guess I mentioned before that this algorithm for period finding is useful for other things. In Quasar's original paper, he also explained how to use basically the same algorithm to find the discrete log, which is also something that's hard to do classically and used in some crypto systems. The same idea can be used to break some other crypto systems like elliptic curve crypto systems. And it shows up in a few other places as well. So if there's no questions, then the next algorithm I want to talk about is Grover's algorithm. So Grover's algorithm is usually phrased as an oracle problem. And it's also sometimes called, the problem is also sometimes called unstructured search. Or database search in some of the earlier literature. So you have an oracle that maps Zn to Z2. So there's n, big N possible inputs, which is usually 2 to the little n. And this oracle, at least to start with, so the problem that we want to do is find figure out if there exists x0 such that O of x0 is 1. So we're trying to figure out if this oracle function is uniformly 0 or if sometimes there's marked elements. So this is phrased as a decision problem, but usually when we're interested in this, we also want to actually find x0, or find one such x0. So sometimes this is phrased as, described as an actual database search problem of, like, you have an unsorted list of telephone numbers, and you're given a phone number, and you want to find the person who that belongs to. Okay. Obviously, if they were sorted, by numerical order, then that would be very easy. But if they're unsorted, then classically you'd have to look through n of them, or O of n of them, until you found the right one. That's not the real application of the quantum case, because then you have to come up with some sort of quantum database that's Euclidean superposition. But you can also think of it as, and it is, in fact, an application for an algorithm, Grover's algorithm, for helping speed up solving NP-complete problems. Right? So suppose you have a 3-sat formula, and you want to find if there's a satisfying assignment. Okay? Well, one way to do that is to try lots of different witnesses, different assignments of the variables. And for each one, it's easy to check if it satisfies or not. That's what this oracle does. It gives, given an assignment, checks whether it's satisfied or not. And then the marked elements, this is called a marked element. The marked elements are the ones that are satisfying. And then classically, again, if this was your strategy, you just have to try things, try one after another. And if you have n, little n variables, then you have 2 to the n possible assignments, which is big N, and you'd have to try O of big N of these things until you found the right one. Unless there's, of course, many, many, many solutions. But assuming that there's very few. And so Grover's algorithm is a quantum algorithm that speeds up this database search algorithm. So let's see. So classically, and this is because this is an Oracle problem, you can actually prove bounds on how many queries it takes. So classically, this takes omega of n queries. So omega of n is like big O of n, except with the inequality the other way. So big O of n means that it takes at most n times some constant queries. Omega of n says that it takes at least some constant times n queries. But of course, you know you can do it with big n queries, because that's just trying all the inputs. So actually, what this is not omega of n, it's theta of n. So theta of n, why don't I write these? So omega of f of n means greater than or equal to constant times f of n. And theta of f of n means omega of f of n and O of f of n. So typically, we have to prove a bound to say a lower bound using omega, and then we, you know, demonstrate an algorithm to show the upper bound. And then if those happen to be the same up to constants, then we have theta of n, and we know the up to constants the exact query complexity. And so in the quantum case, there's a lower bound, which I won't show you, which is omega of square root of n queries. And then Grover's algorithm provides the matching lower bound. That says that it's O of square root of n. So therefore, in the quantum case, it's theta of square root of n. So the intuition behind this speed up, and I'm going to show you the exact algorithm in a little bit, but the intuition is fairly straightforward. So classically, you know, you have these n inputs, you don't know which is the right one, you just have to guess, right? So it's totally makes sense that it should take O of n queries before you get anything. And in particular, if you try guessing things at random, each time you try, you have a probability 1 over n of being right. Right? And then to get that probability up to 1, you should have to try 1 over that many queries in order to have a good chance. Now, quantumly, suppose you have a superposition of things. Now, of course, if you measure, you get down to the probability of 1 over n of getting the right one. But if you don't measure, you have a superposition. Each amplitude is 1 over square root of n of the correct one with lots of incorrect ones. And Grover's algorithm, you can think of as a way of causing those amplitudes to add up coherently, so that you can magnify the amplitude from 1 over square root of n. And each time you do it, you can add another 1 over square root of n. And so you only need roughly square root of n of these queries in order to get them to add up to an amplitude that's order one. OK? Let's see how to manage the time here. So Grover's algorithm, as I said, it can be used to kind of speed up searching for witnesses for NP-complete problems. But it has lots of other applications. So there's just any huge number of list of problems that can be phrased as a search, where you have to try one thing after another. And the important part for Grover's algorithm is that when you try something and it works, and it's right, you can check that. Okay? So any problem that works like this, you can basically speed up using Grover's algorithm. Right? Classically, you have to try order n things. Quantumly, you only have to try order square root of n. So examples, yeah. So you're going to see some applications in the homework. You're going to try a couple of things. And but another one that's maybe worth mentioning, since we've been talking about using Shor's algorithm to pick public key cryptosystems, is that Grover's algorithm can help break private key cryptosystems. So remember, in a private key cryptosystem, Alice and Bob share a key. Eve doesn't know what it is. Okay? And they're information theoretically secure private key cryptosystems, but the more commonly used ones are only computationally secure. And therefore, if Eve were able to guess the key, she would learn what the message was. Okay? But it's hard to guess the key. There's many, many possible keys. And so she has to try lots and lots of different things. But Grover's algorithm, well, she still has to try lots and lots of different things, but it's only the square root as many. Okay? So if you're really doing something that kind of boils down to a brute force attack on these cryptosystems, then Grover's algorithm can speed that up. And you know, since there's exponentials involved, the speedup can be quite large, right? So if classically you had to try 2 to the 20th things, quantumly you'd only have to try about 2 to the 10. Okay? Now those are still actually fairly small numbers, right? 2 to the 20 is just like a million. 2 to the 10 is like 1,000. But it could just as easily have been 2 to the 60, which is totally out of reach, versus 2 to the 30, which is a billion, which is a lot, but kind of reasonable. Okay? So now the upshot is that if you're worried about quantum attack against a private key cryptosystem, you can deal with this because it's still an exponential, but it's a smaller exponential, and so basically you have to double the key length. Okay, that's sort of the bottom line. Okay, so now I have 10 minutes or so. I'm not going to be able to go through all of Grover's algorithm. Okay, let me just get started, and then tomorrow I'll kind of quickly review what we do today. It'll save a little bit of time tomorrow. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to first specialize to the case where there's a unique marked element. So we want to find that one marked element. So otherwise, everything is symmetric, right? So there's one x0 that's special, and then every other x is basically the same. Okay. So what we're going to do is we're going to specialize. So we're going to focus on a two-dimensional subspace. And it's spanned by the states S, which is x0, and T, which is sum over x not equal to x0, x. Okay? And of course, S and T are orthogonal. Now, we don't actually know what this subspace is, because we don't know what x0 is. But Grover's algorithm is still going to move us around inside this subspace. And so for the purpose of analysis, this is the right thing to think about. So let's draw a picture. this is S here. This is G. So suppose we have the state psi, which is in this subspace. So it's alpha S plus beta T. So it's something like this. So what can we do? Well, if we apply the oracle and we use this phase kickback trick from the tutorial, we can apply a phase of minus one so I'm going to indicate this with minus one to the O, this operation. You can apply a phase minus one if we have the marked element, and plus one if we have anything else. So in particular, S gets a phase of minus one relative to T. So this will be minus alpha S plus beta T. And so what is that? In this picture, so the t coefficient t coefficient of psi remains the same, and the s coefficient switches sign. So what do we get? We get this state. Okay, so that's one operation that we have available. So what else can we do?
Wait, what is minus one to the zero?
Minus one to the O. So what else can we do? Well, another state that's in the subspace is the state U, which is S plus T, which is sum over everything. Okay. Which is the Hadamard transform of the all zero state. And so one thing we could do then, let's see, so that state is here, right? Because it's pretty close to T. Is if we had the state all zeros, we could apply phase, we could do a similar reflection, basically. We can apply phase minus one if we have the all zero state, and plus one if we have anything else. So let's take the gate F zero times all zeros equals minus zero. F zero x equals x for x not all zero. And so this is actually, you know, at least order n gates, since it's an n qubit operation, probably more than that. But that doesn't matter, right? Because we're counting the query complexity. And this doesn't use the oracle at all. Right? So this is some unitary, we don't really care how complicated it is. I mean, we'll care when we implement it as an algorithm, but it's in fact polynomial in n. Okay. And then we can make the unitary that's H tensor N F0 H tensor N. And this is a reflection over U. So if we write psi as a superposition of U plus something orthogonal, and the orthogonal thing doesn't get a phase. Sorry, the I want to do the sign the other way, actually. It's a little bit easier that way. So zero, all zeros is not getting a sign, and x is getting a sign when x is not zero. Okay. So what that means is that if you write psi as u plus something orthogonal, your orthogonal part changes sign and the u part stays the same. So this is a reflection not over T, but over U. So down here, so this one gives us this one, and this one here gives us this one, which is minus one to the U psi. Sorry, it's a little crowded. Okay? So what we're going to do, then, is we're going to do one and then the other. This operation G first reflects over T and then reflects over U. And so let's redraw the picture and see what happens. Okay, so first we reflect over T, and so we get this state down here. And so now we want to reflect over U, but remember U is rotated up a little bit. So when we do that, we're going to get something that's up here. So we've rotated psi towards S. Okay? That's good. That's what we want. We want to increase our overlap with S because that's the marked state. Okay. So in particular, if we have an angle theta here and phi here, then reflecting over T gives us an angle phi here. And we have an angle phi plus theta here. So we end up here with an angle phi plus theta. Right, which means that whereas before we were phi away from T, now we're phi plus 2 theta away from T. And so suppose we start at U, and then repeat G about about 1 over 2 theta times. Or really, I guess it's pi over 2 over 2 theta times. Well, then we could be close to S, right? Which is the marked state. So if we do that and then we measure, well, with reasonably high probability, we'll find the marked state. Okay, I guess I should finish this algorithm. So okay, so what's theta? And so this, I could say, this step here is an approximation, but this transformation is exact, right? I haven't made any approximations there. So what's theta? Well, theta is the angle between U and T. And so we know the cosine of theta is so it's going to be the inner product between U and T. But we have to be right about normalization, right? Because because that's, you know, now we're dealing with actual numbers here. Well, with variables. But so the normalization of t should actually be 1 over square root of n minus 1. And the normalization of u could be 1 over square root of n. So let's put those in. So we're taking actually the inner product between 1 over square root of n minus 1 t and 1 over square root of n u. So we get 1 over root n, n minus 1, u t, which is 1 over root n, n minus 1 times sum. I don't really need to do the sum. It's straightforward inner product. So this is sum over everything. This is sum over x not equal to x0. And obviously you get 0 unless you're picking the same term from the sum from each. And so you're going to get n minus 1 terms where they're the same. And then those give you 1. So this is times n minus 1. So square root of n minus 1 over n. Which means that sine theta root 1 minus cosine squared theta is square root of 1 minus this. So it's the square root of 1 over n. Okay. So that means that, so that's giving you the scaling that we're talking about, right? So that means that if you repeat roughly pi over 4 times square root of n times, you get very close to x0. And so that's clearly the right place to stop. And then tomorrow we'll go through, I'll write out the algorithm again just to remind you. And make it 100% precise. And then we'll start to talk about the other cases like multiple marked elements. Okay? Questions?
So you assume that psi is close to t, so you don't overshoot?
We'll talk about it tomorrow. You can overshoot.
Yeah.
If you do too many queries. But if you overshoot only by a little bit, it's not a big deal. If you overshoot by a lot, and it matters a lot.
The point is, if you pick a random state in the subspace, it's probably close to t.
No, that's not necessarily true. But we're starting, we'll initialize to the state u, which is close to t.
I see.
I mean, there's other solutions if you pick a random point in subspace. I guess one thing that's worth noting is that you don't get necessarily exactly s. So when you measure, you get something that it might not be x0. You shouldn't just assume that it's the marked element. You should check it, which takes exactly one query. And then if it's right, you know that it's right. Okay. So all you really need is to have kind of an O of 1 overlap with s. And then you can try a couple of times, and you will get x0 with high probability sooner. So if you do choose a random starting point, then, if you promise that you're in this subspace, I guess you're already kind of most of the way there. You don't have to do anything. Since you don't know what the subspace is, that if you just choose some random state, it won't be in the subspace at all, and things are different. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, then tomorrow we'll finish Grover's algorithm and talk about these gradients.